for this.
Studios in London, New York, Jerusalem, and Miriaha. This is Shire Network News for the weekend ending Friday, August the 5th, 2005.
Hi, I'm your host, Tom Payne. Welcome to Shire Network News, the official podcast of the Anglospheric blog, silentrunning.tv. We look at the news from the perspective of the blogosphere, the motto of which is, you will be assimilated, just as soon as we can figure out how to make a buck off this thing. So the mainstream media is probably still pretty safe. In this edition, we'll have our regular report from Andrew Ian Dodge in London, where Prime Minister Tony Blair shows signs of changing the rules of the game when it comes to importing dangerous Islamic extremists, giving them taxpayer subsidies, and then acting all surprised and hurt when bombs start going off in the tube. His new technique? Exporting them. We're also going to be going right to the centre of world events, to Baghdad, where Omar, one of the bloggers who writes Iraq the Model, is going to talk about the security situation and provide tips on blogging from a war zone.
All you see on TV is car bombs and suicide attacks and assassinations, but that's not the whole life. There is a life in Iraq. There are 27 million people living here every day. They go to work, their children go to school. There is a whole life that is being reduced to just an image of suicide bomb, and that's not right.
Lawrence Simon will be along with the Full of Crap report, and finally we'll hear from Mick Fealty from the Ulster blog / news site Slugger O'Toole, who'll be giving us some thoughts on the IRA announcement it's giving up violence, and also why his blog is named after a drunk.
You know, trying to explain Northern Ireland to a complete stranger is a bit like talking to a drunk man. You've got to do it bit by bit.
Right now, though, let's go to Andrew Ian Dodge in London.
Good afternoon. This is Andrew Ian Dodge talking to you from a relatively overcast London and a town that got through Thursday, exactly a month after the bombing. While being a bit tensed, we got through it, and everybody seems to be all right. Nothing happened, which I don't think has anything to do with the Islamist and paranoia. I think it has more to do with the security services. This morning, Mr. Blair basically did something we never thought we'd hear him do. He turned on the Islamists in a big way. He's proposed that Islamists will be booted out of the country if they're not local. If they've been given leave to remain, they'll still be kicked out. And that preaching hatred will be something that is come down on hard. Not only that, but he's proposing to close mosques that are havens for hatred. Everybody's rather shocked, and it was amusing to hear the questions, because some of them were so shocked at what he was saying, echoing some of the sentiments of a Tory leader, that they didn't even come up with good questions. The best one I heard, of course, is the question who asked whether Ken Livingston would fall into this remit, considering his sycophancy towards preachers of hate. A lot of people are calling it the British Patriot Act. As he says, even Tony Blair has realized the rules of the game have changed. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that recently Scott Burgess and a whole bunch of other bloggers managed to get a Islamist kicked out of running for The Guardian. And in fact, there are several others at The Guardian who lost their jobs because of it. Now, one has to wonder whether bloggers such as Harry's Place, hopefully my blog, Scott Burgess, and Damien Penny and a few others had an effect on the decision of the government. We do know that the government, that there are people in government who read places like Harry's Place and the 5th of November, so we can assume that they probably keep track of these blogs. And Harry's Place and the rest of us have kept up the pressure on pointing out that some of these so-called moderate groups are not moderate at all. And the most recent example, of course, is the organization MPAC UK, which had a cartoon depicting a Jew as, it looked like, a monster out of Where the Wild Things Are, under an American flag. Not only was this plagiarized, it was plagiarized from an extremist far-right site, neo-Nazi site. Needless to say, they've taken it down. Another interesting thing that's been going on in London is the multiculturalism. It's now being questioned, which didn't used to happen. For example, the Telegraph is full of it. The Sun has turned on these extremist nutcases. It was rather interesting. One of these extremists showed up on Newsnight and ranted on, and someone must have told him that no one that watches Newsnight would be too upset by that, because they're all multiculturalists. Anyway, the Sun had someone watching it, and it showed up on the front of the Sun the next day. Now, when the Sun gets on your butt, you know you're in trouble. And obviously, Blair, being the populist, realized that the public mood had turned, and that it was okay for him to turn around and start coming down hard on these people. Other than that, London is trying to return to normal. It's still a bit tense. Of course, you have Muslims whinging that when they sit down on a bus or in an airplane, even on the tube, that people move seats. I'm hopping on the tube in about 10 minutes to go see the lovely Tabitha, looking around to see how it's changed. It's pretty interesting that the Americans are now fairly interested in what's going on in London. I just did another one of my five-minute pieces for WLOB on the state of London. And hopefully, sometime in the next couple weeks, after the 20th of August, I will have something for Bruce to listen to, and the rest of you. Form of Cry Freedom. I'd like to say hello to my friend from Northern Ireland and comment on how interesting it is, the fact that while the IRA supposedly has given up their weapons, they've been replaced by someone even more dangerous. Andrew Ian Dodge, AndrewIanDodge.com, of course, LibertyCadre.net, and DisgracefulMusic.com. Goodbye.
Iraq and Baghdad are still very much the center of world events. The struggle of the country to move forward into a democratic future after a brutal totalitarian dictatorship and a war with a US-led coalition is being hampered by a vicious terrorist campaign. The Western media seems to take particular glee in reporting every setback, every casualty, every attack as an example of the failure of the entire enterprise. Having failed to stop the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, there appear to be many in the West determined to do what they can to sabotage any chance of ordinary Iraqis having a future, simply so they can feel their political views have been vindicated. But arguments in the West over who said what and when and who was right or wrong about WMDs don't really matter to the people who are most affected, Iraqis. In the wake of the overthrow of Saddam Hussein by US-led forces, there's been an explosion of new media outlets in the country, and that includes blogs. One of the most prominent of these is Iraq the Model. It's written by two brothers, Muhammad and Omar. I asked Omar how he came to start a blog in the middle of a war zone.
Iraq has been a point of interest and attention in the world in the last few decades, and we wanted to share our thoughts, our own opinions from inside Iraq. We hear the people outside Iraq talking about Iraq and discussing the situation here, the war, the regime, the progress, whether it's happening or not. And we wanted to share our thoughts about that. We are the people who live here, and we know, we feel that we know more than others about our country. So we're interested in starting and finding a way to get our voices out. And the easiest way we found was blogging. Actually, I found about it from a friend of mine. His name is Ziad. He started a blog in October 2003, and he told me about the idea of blogging and how easy it is, how fast posts can be published, and of course it's free and it's accessible from any internet connection.
What sort of a response have you had from people both inside Iraq and also outside to your blog?
Well, actually, my blog isn't well known in Iraq, you know, because of the language mainly. I post all the time in English, and most people here go to Arabic websites.
But your audience would obviously be a little bit more outside Iraq, so to a certain extent, you're explaining Iraq to outsiders through an English language blog.
Yeah, actually, that was our main goal. People inside Iraq know a lot about Iraq because they live in it, but I've seen that the media was not portraying the real image from Iraq. So we wanted to cover the hidden parts of the story, the parts that are ignored, the parts that are being misrepresented by the media. We wanted to show that to the people and discuss that with them.
Well, what is being misrepresented? We turn on our TV screens here in the West every day and we see explosions, we see car bombs, we see dead people. That is obviously part of the reality of life, but in what way are you saying that we're not seeing the totality of the picture?
You just said it. All you see on TV is car bombs and suicide attacks and assassinations, but that's not the whole life. There is a life in Iraq. There are 27 million people living here every day. They go to work, their children go to school, and there is a political process going on. There is democracy being built. There is a whole life that is being reduced to just an image of suicide bomb, and that's not right.
You know there's a big debate going on in the West about whether the war was correct and also whether America should pull out of Iraq. How do people in Iraq feel about this debate going on outside the country?
Well, let me be frank to you. The vast majority of Iraqis were happy that Saddam was gone. Were happy when the coalition troops marched into Baghdad and toppled Saddam. It doesn't mean that they're all satisfied with everything that was done after that. There have been some mistakes, of course. On the end of the Iraqi government that came later, or the American administration. But in general, people still think that the war itself, taking the regime out, was right. I don't think people would like to go back to the days before when Saddam was still here.
But what about the people in the West who say that the insurgency can't be defeated and that the only thing to do is for America to pull out and leave Iraq to its own devices?
I think most Iraqis agree with me on this point, that if America pulled its troops from Iraq right now, it's going to be a disaster for Iraq and for America. We can't let go at this point. This is a very critical stage. If America withdrew from Iraq, Iraq is going to fall in the hands of militias, terrorists, and there will be endless conflict, internal conflict, and there will be interference from outside the country. Until there is a strong Iraqi army, there's strong security forces, we'll still need the American and British troops to remain in Iraq.
Is it dangerous for someone like you to say this sort of thing, to blog freely? I mean, there was a blogger, an American writer, who was killed down in Basra just this week.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's a very sad incident, actually. Well, you know, I work most of the time from home. I publish my posts from home, and I don't publicly talk about my blog. I might discuss the subject, but I don't say that I'm doing this and this. So, yes, it could be dangerous to go out to the streets and pick up your camera and start shooting pictures. It's that dangerous. And, of course, it's more dangerous for foreigners than for Iraqis, but it still could be dangerous because some Iraqi journalists were also killed or kidnapped in some places. So journalism in general and also blogging is a dangerous job in Iraq.
Having a foreign army in your country is never a pleasant experience, and in fact it's not a very pleasant experience for the people in the occupying army. How are the Americans and the troops perceived by Iraqis?
Actually, if you go back to the first few months after the liberation, after the Operation Iraq Freedom, the relationship between Iraqi people and the coalition army and the soldiers was just fine. It was too friendly. But soldiers became more cautious and suspicious of people after they were being attacked. And sometimes people get in the crossfire. And that made them also feel cautious and suspicious. So I can say that the terrorist attacks and the attacks of the insurgents have created some kind of a gap between the Iraqi people and the coalition soldiers. They don't want to be close to each other because everyone thinks that would expect someone to attack one of them and there will be like some shooting and someone could get hurt in it. So they try to avoid being in close proximity with each other. I can't tell about how people feel, what they think inside in their mind, but I think that's the general attitude.
There's a question I want to ask from a sort of a personal angle. I've never really understood, despite the fact that I've been to the Middle East a couple of times, the very strange attitude that many, many people have about Jews. I'm Jewish myself, and I've never really been able to work out where this antagonistic attitude came from.
Well, I think the problem was created by the Arab regime, mainly. And that happened back in 1948 and the few years that followed that. You know, before 1948, almost 20% of Baghdad's population was Jewish, and they lived in peace with the rest of the residents of Baghdad. They were just neighbors and friends, and everything was going fine. But after Israel was formed in 1948, and the regime deported the Jews from the Arab countries, and they started their huge media campaign against the Jewish people, you know, it's a long legacy of fed hatred that the regime fed to the people. So it was transmitted from one generation to the other. It's more like it's not the people themselves who think that, who brought that attitude. I think it's mainly the regimes and the religious extremists.
Is Iraq better off now than it was under Saddam Hussein?
Well, you can't answer that question in general. You know, there are some aspects of life that are way better off, and there are some aspects that are worse. But in my opinion, the overall is way better off. I mean, in aspects of economy, freedom of speech, all kinds of human rights in general, even in terms of personal safety, I think Iraq is better now, because even though the streets now are too dangerous, but if we make a simple calculation, if you see the numbers of the figures of people that were killed during the reign of Saddam and in like 2 years' time, and compare that with the number of people who lost their lives in the last 2 years, you'll see that Saddam has killed more people than the war and the current terrorism attacks did.
If there was one thing you would want people outside Iraq to know about life there, one message you'd like to give to people outside, what would it be?
I want them to know that Iraqis want a better life, and they want it so bad, and they're trying to have that life. They're trying to build that life for them and for children, and they need help to do that. They don't want their country to be ruled by terrorists or extremists. They don't want their country to be ruled by dictators. They want freedom, and they want their rights just like any other human being on this planet. People outside need to know that. Some people have this misconception that Iraqis just want to go back to living under dictatorship, or that they want a Sharia law governing their life. And that's not true. Iraq used to be a civilized country before the Ba'athists came and took over control. People here really want to build their country back.
That was Omar, one of the writers from the blog Iraq the Model. I'm sure we all hope that the people of Iraq do get the chance to form their own free state and society. Time now for some humour. In accordance with FCC regulations concerning mandatory levels of funniness in podcasts, here's Lawrence Simon.
Hello everyone, this is Lawrence Simon and welcome to this week's Full of Crap Report. Well, if you've read my site, you know I have a special place in my heart for that shriveled White House barnacle fossil, Helen Thomas. Apparently, she believes that a press conference isn't where you ask questions, but you hurl insults and outbursts like a moon bat protest rally. You know, like a common, ordinary, blogger. Helen is from a different age of reporter, somewhere between the Cretaceous and the Jurassic, I believe. A time when it wasn't just dog-eat-dog, but civilized people ruled the earth, asking civilized questions of an open, an honest, civilized government. Apparently, she's also from another dimension, too, because back in her youth, there was a cripple named Franklin D. Roosevelt, who couldn't walk, but the press kept that fact away from the public, you know, for the country's good. I guess they didn't have time to cover it because they were too busy not covering the fact that he screwed around on his wife, too. Ah, to be young and in the middle of a world war again. But that, amazingly enough, was before Helen's time at the big house on Pennsylvania Avenue. She started with Jack Kennedy, long after presidents screwed around on their wives, or their brothers had their friends in the mafia killed abroad to cover the story up. So, what's my beef with this unwrapped reject from an Egyptology exhibit? Well, Helen Thomas's friend, Albert Eisel, I think I'm pronouncing that right, he's an editor of the publication The Hill. Well, he had a lovely chat with Helen over a certain man named Dick Cheney that resulted in Helen say that she'd commit suicide if Cheney ran for president in 2008. Helen, the supposedly veteran and experienced journalist who's covered every president since JFK, thought it was off the record. You know, private stuff, things that, you know, you want to keep in your scrapbook, have tattooed on your ass and show nobody, you know, a secret between friends. Eisel published this tidbit of Cheney information in a column called Off the Record. Let that little antonym of itself sink in. A publication of stuff that isn't meant to be published. Yeah, that's a smart name, only in Washington. Here's Eisel's defense. But the larger lesson here And one, I'm surprised Ms. Thomas, who has been a Washington reporter since 1943 and retired as UPI's White House correspondent in 2000, failed to understand, is that off the record is a virtually meaningless term, which is why this column bears the name it does. It's bad enough that public officials hide behind it to discredit their critics, as the CIA link in Broglio demonstrates, but even worse when reporters do it. Oh, even better, he blames Matt Drudge for linking the information and spreading it around the world. You know, if you don't want something to be on the record, shut the hell up. Don't blabber on about it. And if you don't want something linked, don't publish it on the web. The best secret is one you keep to yourself, stupid. Kind of makes you wonder why she retired from UPI in the first place. Or was she forcibly retired because she was losing her grip on how things really work in Washington, journalism, and, well, pretty much reality. So let's just tally up the crap scoreboard here. ISO, full of crap. Matt Drudge makes a pile of crap look even bigger. And Helen Thomas is just overflowing like an old crap volcano. Volcrapno, crapcano, cornucrapia, whatever. This is Lawrence Simon. And if you're full of crap, shut the hell up!
Thanks, Leah. Hey, Leah, do you think that Frank Jay's going to let me have a cameo role in the IMAO podcast soon? You know, like you said, that night in the back of your car when I let you... You know, you said you were on first name terms with Harvey and Space Monkey, and that Sarah Kay sends you Christmas cards because she forgets you're Jewish, and it'd mean a lot for my career, and I'd be really grateful if you know what I mean. Call me, okay? Ah, fame, the fickle bitch goddess. You're listening to Shire Network News, the official podcast of silentrunning.tv. I'm Tom Payne. To the serious stuff again. If you can call Gerry Adams condemning violence serious and not rupture yourself trying not to laugh. Yes, it's that other terrorist outfit, the one that used to be all glamorous and headline-grabbing back in the day, before that bunch of Middle Eastern crackpots came along and went completely over the top and spoiled the whole concept of terrorism for everyone else. Yep, it's our chums, the IRA. More specifically, the Provisional IRA, not to be confused with the official IRA, and certainly nothing to do with the real IRA, Continuity IRA, Diet IRA, Low-Fat IRA, I can't believe it's not the IRA. Their political wing, bullshit, Sinn Féin, has apparently glanced up at their supporters and realised they're living up to their Gaelic name Ourselves Alone rather too well. Gerry Adams has decided he prefers invites to the White House for St. Paddy's Day and having 13 or 14 tall drinks of an afternoon round at Ted Kennedy's compound at Hyannisport to skulking around Bogside in an unfashionable balaclava, carrying a rusty Armalite and wondering if a sniper from Two Parrot is about to slot him. I spoke with Mick Fealty, the man in charge of the Northern Ireland specialist blog cum news portal Slugger O'Toole, about the IRA's announcement it's giving up the armed struggle, and asked him if they can be believed.
I suppose the short answer is yes, on the basis that it's very politically it's politically dangerous to say you're going to do something, one thing, and then go and do something else. I also think you need to see it in the context in which the announcement comes. It's really the kind of it's the end process of a call that was made by Gerry Adams on the first day of the Westminster elections back in April. He called for the IRA basically to give up the military route and to pursue politics purely through democratic means. And this is basically, you know, kind of three months later, they finally kind of ground through it all and they've said yes. However, in the wider context, the statement and the suspension of the campaign is politically useless unless it actually has an effect on Sinn Féin's opponents, effectively Ian Paisley and the DUP and the kind of wider unionist community. And ultimately, it's they're the people who can kind of make things go ahead. And that's really the kind of short-term aim of this statement. It won't achieve that aim until unionists are convinced that there is no going back for Sinn Féin or the IRA. It's not going to do that overnight. We've seen Paisley and various other kind of leading members of his party say, we don't trust anything these guys say, but after a period of time, if it's been proven that they are actually on ceasefire, not ceasefire, but actually they have actually ended all military and criminal activities, then yes, we will go back into government.
For the benefit of our listeners who don't know all the ins and outs of Ulster politics dating back 100 or 200 years, what does this mean for the ultimate long-term future of Ulster? Is it going to remain part of the United Kingdom, or does Sinn Féin think that it's going to achieve its United Ireland through political means rather than through the gun?
Well, I think Sinn Féin remains convinced that it can actually promote the option of unification through democratic means. That was, you know, that was the full import of the Adams Initiative, and this is a packing away of the guns. Whether that's long term or not, I suspect it is, but that's a lot to do with the kind of renewed prosperity of the Irish economy. You know, the historic relationship between Britain and the island of Ireland in general has always been, you know, kind of one of rich and poor, powerful and less powerful influence. That fundamental relationship has changed, and I think that's ultimately probably what has driven most of the protagonists in Northern Ireland to coming to some kind of democratic agreement that, you know, they have to take their arguments through democracy rather than onto the streets or to prosecute it at the end of, you know, a gun or a bombing campaign.
For a long time, the province of Ulster was much more developed than Southern Ireland, but that's kind of been reversed in the last few decades, isn't it?
Well, you've only got to drive the road from Dublin to Belfast to see where the investment is going. I mean, to a degree, what you're seeing is a kind of a leapfrogging thing. You know, up to 10, 15 years ago, there was very little major kind of economic activity in the Republic, very little revenue to be able to invest in major kind of infrastructure. And you know, if you look at that road now, it's a fast road up to the border from Dublin to the north. And, you know, the road that continues from Newry up to Belfast is the road that was put in there 40 years ago in the 60s.
Tell me about blogs. Have they been able to play a role in bringing various communities together, or just as divisive as other news sites?
No, I think they have done. I think, in a way, blogging has simply come in where bulletin boards have been and various kind of dialogue sites have been for a good 10, 12 years. And I think they have, their major advantage is that they're virtual spaces and that they actually allow people to talk and confront each other who just wouldn't be able to do it in the normal run of their lives. Now, that doesn't mean to say when people talk, they agree. In fact, the important thing is that they don't agree. But sometimes, you know, you actually find situations where, you know, people who are headline Republicans and others who are headline Unionists actually find they have some moral, social and political values in common, whilst they may disagree on 80%. The fact that you have, you know, 10 or 20% in common with someone who's an inveterate enemy is actually quite a humanizing, democratizing process. I think that's not simply tied in with blogs. I do think that has been, you know, that has been a characteristic of internet dialogue, you know, right from the very beginning.
Tell us a bit about your site, Sluggerotal. It's not just a blog, is it? It's a bit wider than that.
Quick pot of history. It's about 3 years old. I set it up in June 2002 as a personal research site. I just had the idea of tagging stories that I thought were important or contained, you know, important intellectual capital relating to Northern Ireland's politics and culture. Within about 3 weeks, I managed to work out, because I'm completely naive as far as technology is concerned, it took me 3 weeks to work out how to read the logs, and I realized there were 80 to 90 people logging on every day.
It's a grand feeling, isn't it?
There's a feeling of pleasant surprise and mild shock associated with it, because I hadn't really imagined that I was writing to an audience. But I think from the beginning, I've never really been interested in pushing my own opinion as to what is actually happening in Northern Ireland. I've been much more interested in finding diversity and conflict within other people's opinions. I suppose about, when was it? It was probably the following February where I began to publish my own research interviews with various kind of key people in the unionist community, that the dialogue thing started to take off. And we, you know, first of all, attracted a lot of people who were interested in the unionist point of view, and then counter views to that. But and so we have, you know, as well as a conventional blog, we have, you know, quite an exceptionally high amount of people commenting on each of the stories that get put out. And, you know, that can, you know, on occasions that's led to some very, very good high-level deconstruction of, you know, kind of complex issues.
And what about the actual name, for the benefit of our listeners who are not familiar with every record the Dubliners put out?
Well, Slugger O'Toole, it started off as a letter to Slugger O'Toole. Slugger O'Toole is one of the crew members of a fictitious ship called the Irish Rover. Each one of them has a line, and the line that goes to Slugger O'Toole is Slugger O'Toole, who was drunk as a rule.
There was Slugger O'Toole, who was drunk as a rule, and fighting belts right me from Dover. And you're not like the clown from the banks of the Thames. What's the skull and the Irish Rover?
So the original idea was to write a letter to a drunk man, because, you know, trying to explain Northern Ireland to a complete stranger is a bit like talking to a drunk man. You've got to do it bit by bit, little by little, and just kind of, you know, hope that gradually, you know, the kind of understanding of the complexity of the situation begins to kind of weigh through to people.
I should have asked you this question at the front part of the interview, which is, of course, what more or less, you know, side do you come from? The very simple way to find out which community someone from Oscar is from, it's a very simple question. What is the name of the city on Lough Foyle?
Derry stroke Londonderry.
But you said Derry first.
That was Derry, yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, you know, I was kind of born, raised Catholic, and my natural sort of sensibilities would be nationalist. However, I've lived in England for about 20 years, and I've spent a long time, you know, kind of away from the situation. So I'm not aiming for objectivity, but I am quite deliberately interested in diversity of view. So as far as Slugger's concerned, you know, I suppose, to paraphrase one British Secretary of State, you know, I have no strategic interest in any one particular outcome or another. So as far as the site's concerned, and as far as Northern Ireland's concerned, it's really there to express what the dominant arguments are at any one given moment in time. It's not really there to, you know, particularly advocate one or the other. Though sometimes we have to defend the right of some people to speak when others would rather they didn't.
That was Mick Fielty from the excellent Slugger O'Toole, which you really should bookmark and visit regularly if you're interested in Northern Ireland. Well, that's it from me, Tom Payne, for another week. You've been listening to Shire Network News, the official podcast of silentrunning.tv. Next week, we'll be looking at the general election coming up in New Zealand. Are the voters going to toss out the failed Euro-socialism and politically correct multicultural grievance industry of the Helen Clark-led Labour Party and install the centre-right National Party of former Reserve Bank Governor Don Brash? If New Zealand veers rightwards, could this mean there's hope for Canada as well, where a not dissimilar political situation exists? Could the Anglosphere take a baby step towards reunification if New Zealanders wake up? Tune in next week and we'll ask the important question, can the hobbits fight back? Until next week, may your God go with you.